asked. He took my hand and he said, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry." I asked, "Sorry for what?" And he said, "I can't live the rest of my life in a cage, Granny. I'm so sorry." We took the bus back to Gurgaon and had lunch at the tea shop. It was very hot, and we sweated a lot, and that was all that happened today. Write whatever you want after that to her, and post it tomorrow, as soon as I leave in the car. But not before. Understand? It was raining all morning, a light, persistent kind of rain. I heard the rain, though I could not see it. I went to the Honda City, placed the incense stick inside, wiped the seats, wiped the stickers, and punched the ogre in the mouth. I threw a bundle near the driver's seat. I shut all the doors and locked them. Then, taking two steps back from the Honda City, I bowed low to it with folded palms. I went to see what Daram was doing. He was looking lonely, so I made a paper boat for him, and we sailed it in the gutter outside the apartment block. After lunch, I called Daram into my room. I put my hands on his shoulders. Slowly I turned him around so he faced away from me. I dropped a rupee coin on the ground. "Bend down and pick that up." He did so, and I watched. Daram combed his hair just like Mr. Ashok did, with a part down the middle. When you stood up over him, there was a clear white line down his scalp, leading up to the spot on the crown where the strands of a man's hairline radiate from. "Stand up straight." I turned him around a full circle. I dropped the rupee again. "Pick it up one more time." I watched the spot, telling him to sit in a corner of the room and keep watch over me. I went inside my mosquito net, folded my legs, closed my eyes, touched my palms to my knees, and breathed in. I don't know how long I sat like the Buddha, but it lasted until one of the servants shouted out that I was wanted at the front door. I opened my eyes. Daram was sitting in a corner of the room, watching me. "Come here," I said. I gave him a hug and put 10 rupees into his pocket. He'd need that.
"Balram, you're late. The bell is ringing like crazy."
I walked to the car, inserted the key, and turned the engine on. Mr. Ashok was standing at the entrance with an umbrella and a cell phone. He was talking on the phone as he got into the car and slammed the door.
"I still can't believe it. The people of this country had a chance to put an efficient ruling party back in power, and instead they have voted in the most outrageous bunch of thugs. We don't deserve..."
He put the phone aside for a moment and said, "First to the city, Balram. I'll tell you where." And then resumed the phone talk. The roads were greasy with mud and water. I drove slowly.
"Parliamentary democracy, Father. We will never catch up with China for this single reason."
First stop was in the city, at one of the usual banks. He took the red bag and went in, and I saw him inside the glass booth, pressing the buttons of the cash machine. When he came back, I could feel that the weight of the bag on the back seat had increased. We went from bank to bank, and the weight of the red bag grew. I felt its pressure increase on my lower back, as if I were taking Mr. Ashok and his bag not in a car, but the way my father would take a customer and his bag, in a rickshaw. 700,000 rupees. It was enough for a house, a motorbike, and a small shop, a new life. My 700,000 rupees. "Now to the Sheraton, Balram."
"Yes, sir."
I turned the key, started the car, changed gear. We moved. "Play some Sting, Balram, not too loud."
"Yes, sir."
I put the CD on. The voice of Sting came on. The car picked up speed. In a little while, we passed the famous bronze statue of Gandhi leading his followers from darkness to the light. Now the road emptied. The rain was coming down lightly. If we kept going this way, we would come to the hotel, the grandest of all in the capital of my country, the place where visiting heads of state, like yourself, always stay. But Delhi is a city where civilization can appear and disappear within 5 minutes. On either side of us, right now, there was just wilderness and rubbish. In the rearview mirror, I saw him paying attention to nothing but his cell phone. A blue glow from the phone lit up his face. Without looking up, he asked me, "What's wrong, Balram? Why has the car stopped?"
I touched the magnetic stickers of the goddess Kali for luck, then opened the glove compartment. There it was, the broken bottle with its claws of glass. "There's something off with the wheel, sir. Just give me a couple of minutes." Before I could even touch it, I swear, the door of the car opened. I was out in the drizzle. There was soggy black mud everywhere. Picking my way over mud and rainwater, I squatted near the left rear wheel, which was hidden from the road by the body of the car. There was a large clump of bushes to one side, and a stretch of wasteland beyond. "You've never seen the road this empty. You'd swear it's been arranged just for you." The only light inside the car was the blue glow from his cell phone. I rapped against his glass with a finger. He turned to me without lowering the window. I mouthed out the words, "There's a problem, sir." He did not lower the window. He did not step out. He was playing with his cell phone, punching the buttons and grinning. He must be sending a message to Ms. Uma. Pressed to the wet glass, my lips made a grin. He released the phone. I made a fist and thumped on his glass. He lowered the window with a look of displeasure. Sting's soft voice came through the window. "What is it, Balram?" "Sir, will you step out? There is a problem." "What problem?" His body just wouldn't budge. It knew, the body knew, though the mind was too stupid to figure it out. "The wheel, sir. I'll need your help. It's stuck in the mud." Just then the headlights flashed on me. A car was coming down the road. My heart skipped a beat, but it just drove right past us, splashing muddy water at my feet. He put a hand on the door and was about to step out, but some instinct of self-preservation still held him back. "It's raining, Balram. Do you think we should call for help?" He wriggled and moved away from the door. "Oh, no, sir. Trust me. Come out." He was still wriggling. His body was moving as far from me as it could. "I'm losing him," I thought, and this forced me to do something I knew I would hate myself for, even years later. I really didn't want to do this. I really didn't want him to think, even in the 2 or 3 minutes he had left to live, that I was that kind of driver, the one that resorts to blackmailing his master. But he had left me no option. "It's been giving problems ever since that night we went to the hotel in Jangpura." He looked up from the cell phone at once. "The one with the big T sign on it. You remember it, don't you, sir? Ever since that night, sir, nothing has been the same with this car." His lips parted, then closed. He's thinking, blackmail? Or an innocent reference to the past? Don't give him time to settle. "Come out of the car, sir. Trust me." Putting the cell phone on the seat, he obeyed me. The blue light of the cell phone filled the inside of the dark car for a second, then went out. He opened the door farthest from me and got out near the road. I got down on my knees and hid behind the car. "Come over this side, sir. The bad tire is on this side." He came, picking his way through the mud. "It's this one, sir, and be careful. There's a broken bottle lying on the ground." There was so much garbage by the roadside that it lay there looking perfectly natural. "Here, let me throw it away. This is the tire, sir. Please take a look." He got down on his knees. I rose up over him, holding the bottle held behind my back with a bent arm. Down below me, his head was just a black ball, and in the blackness, I saw a thin white line of scalp between the neatly parted hair, leading like a painted line on a highway to the spot on the crown of his skull, the spot from which a man's hair radiates out. The black ball moved, grimacing to protect his eyes against the drizzle. He looked up at me. "It seems fine." I stood still, like a schoolboy caught out by his teacher. I thought, that landlord's brain of his has figured it out. He's going to stand up and hit me in the face. But what is the use of winning a battle when you don't even know that there is a war going on? "Well, you know more about this car than I do, Balram. Let me take another look." And he peered again at the tire. The black highway appeared before me once more, with the white paint marks leading to the crown spot. There is a problem, sir. You should have got a replacement a long time ago. All right, Balram. He touched the tire. But I really think we... I rammed the bottle down. The glass ate his bone. I rammed it 3 times into the crown of his skull, smashing through it to his brains. It's a good, strong bottle, Johnny Walker Black. Well worth its resale value. The stunned body fell into the mud. A hissing sound came out of its lips, like wind escaping from a tire. I fell to the ground. My hand was trembling. The bottle slipped out, and I had to pick it up with my left hand. The thing with the hissing lips got up onto its hands and knees. It began crawling around in a circle, as if looking for someone who was meant to protect it. Why didn't I gag him and leave him in the bushes, stunned and unconscious, where he wouldn't be able to do a thing for hours while I escaped? Good question. And I've thought about it many a night, as I sit at my desk, looking at the chandelier. The first possible reply is that he could always recover, break out of his gag, and call the police. So I had to kill him. The second possible reply is that his family was going to do such terrible things to my family. I was just getting my revenge in advance. I like the second reply better. Putting my foot on the back of the crawling thing, I flattened it to the ground. Down on my knees I went, to be at the right height for what would come next. I turned the body around so it would face me. I stamped my knee on its chest. I undid the collar button and rubbed my hand over its clavicles to mark out the spot. When I was a boy in Laxmangar, and I used to play with my father's body, the junction of the neck and the chest, the place where all the tendons and veins stick out in high relief, was my favorite spot. When I touched this spot, the pit of my father's neck, I controlled him. I could make him stop breathing with the pressure of a finger. The stork's son opened his eyes just as I pierced his neck, and his lifeblood spurted into my eyes. I was blind. I was a free man. When I got the blood out of my eyes, it was all over for Mr. Ashok. The blood was draining from the neck quite fast. I believe that is the way the Muslims kill their chickens. But then tuberculosis is a worse way to go than this, I assure you. After dragging the body into the bushes, I plunged my hands and face into the rainwater and muck. I picked up the bundle near my feet, the white cotton t-shirt, the one with lots of white space and just one word in English, and changed into it. Reaching for the gilded box of tissues, I wiped my face and hands clean. I pulled out all the stickers of the goddess and threw them on Mr. Ashok's body, just in case they'd help his soul go to heaven. And then getting into the car, turning the ignition key, putting my foot on the accelerator, I took the Honda City, finest of cars, most faithful of accomplices, on one final trip. Since there was no one else in the car, my left hand reached out to turn Sting off, then stopped and relaxed. From now on I could play the music as long as I wanted. In the railway station, 33 minutes later, the colored wheels in the fortune machines were coruscating. I stood in front of them, staring at the glowing and the whirling, and wondering, should I go back to get Dharam? If I left him there now, the police would certainly arrest him as an accomplice. They would throw him into jail with a bunch of wild men. And you know what happens to little boys when they get put into dens like that, sir. On the other hand, if I went back now all the way to Gurgaon, someone might discover the body, and then all this, I tightened my grip on the bag, would have been a waste. I squatted on the floor of the station, pressed down by indecision. There was a squealing noise to my left. A plastic bucket was tumbling about, as if it were alive. Then a grinning black face popped out of the bucket. A little creature, a baby boy, a homeless man and woman covered in filth, sat on either side of the bucket, gazing blankly into the distance. Between his fatigued parents, this little thing was having the time of his life, playing with the water and splashing it on passers-by. "Don't do it, little boy," I said. He splashed more water, squealing with pleasure each time he hit me. I raised my hand. He ducked into his bucket and kept thrashing from the inside. I reached into my pockets, searched for a rupee coin, checked to make sure it wasn't a 2-rupee coin, and rolled it toward the bucket. Then I sighed and got up, and cursed myself, and walked out of the station. Your lucky day, Dharam. The 7th night. Can you hear that, Mr. Jabbao? I'll turn it up for you. The health minister today announced a plan to eliminate malaria in Bangalore by the end of the year. He has instructed all city officials to work without holiday until malaria is a thing of the past. 45 million rupees will be allocated to malaria eradication. In other news, the chief minister of the state today announced a plan to eliminate malnutrition in Bangalore in 6 months. He declared that there would be not one hungry child in the city by the end of the year. All officials are to work single-mindedly toward this goal, he declared. 500 million rupees will be allocated for malnutrition eradication. In other news, the finance minister declared that this year's budget will include special incentives to turn our villages into high-technology paradises. This is the kind of news they feed us on All India Radio night after night. And tomorrow at dawn, it'll be in the papers too. People just swallow this crap, night after night, morning after morning. Amazing, isn't it? But enough of the radio. It's turned off. Now let me look into my chandelier for inspiration. When? Old friend! Tonight we bring this glorious tale to a conclusion, as I was doing my yoga this morning. That's right, I wake up at 11 in the morning every day and go straight into an hour of yoga. I began reflecting on the progress of my story, and realized that I'm almost done. All that remains to be told is how I changed from a hunted criminal into a solid pillar of Bangalorean society. Incidentally, sir, while we're on the topic of yoga, may I just say that an hour of deep breathing, yoga and meditation in the morning constitutes the perfect start to the entrepreneur's day. How I would handle the stresses of this fucking business without yoga, I have no idea. Make yoga a must in all Chinese schools. That's my suggestion. But back to the story now. First, I want to explain one thing about a fugitive's life. Being a man on the run isn't all about fear. A fugitive is entitled to his share of fun, too. That evening, as I was sweeping up the pieces of the Johnny Walker bottle in the parking lot, I worked out a plan for how I would get to Bangalore. It wouldn't be on a direct train, no. Someone might see me, and then the police would know where I had gone. Instead, I would transfer myself from train to train, zigzagging my way down to Bangalore. Although my schedule was shot to pieces when I went to get Dharam, he was sleeping in the net, and I woke him up and said we were going on a holiday to the south, and dragged him out, and it was hard to keep my red bag in one hand and Dharam in the other hand, for the train station is a dangerous place for a little boy, you know. Lots of shady characters around. Still, I began to move in this zigzag way south from Delhi. On the 3rd day of traveling like this, red bag in hand, I was at Hyderabad, waiting in line at the station tea shop to buy a cup of tea before my train left. Dharam was guarding the seat in the compartment. There was a gecko just above the tea shop, and I was looking at it with concern, hoping it would move before it was my turn to get tea. The gecko turned to the left. It ran over a large piece of paper posted on the wall. It stood still for a moment, like that, then darted to the side. That large piece of paper on the wall was a police poster. My police poster. It had already arrived here. I looked at it with a smile of pride. A smile that lasted just a second. For some bizarre reason, you'll see how sloppily things get done in India. My poster had been stapled to another poster of 2 guys from Kashmir, 2 terrorists, wanted for bombing something or the other. You'd almost think, looking at the posters, that I was a terrorist too. How annoying. I realized that I was being watched. A fellow with his hands behind his back was looking at the poster and at me most intently. I began to tremble. I edged away from the poster, but I was too late. The moment he saw me leaving, he ran up to me, caught my wrist and stared at my face. Then he said, "What's it say? That poster you're reading?"
"Read it for yourself."
"Can't." Now I understood why he had come running. It was the desperation of an illiterate man to get the attention of the literate man. From his accent I knew he was from the darkness, too. "It's the wanted men list for this week," I said. "Those two are terrorists from Kashmir."
"What did they do?"
"They blew up a school. They killed 8 children."
"And this fellow? The one with the mustache?"
He tapped my photo with a knuckle of his right hand.
"He's the guy who caught them."
"How did he do that?"
"To create the illusion I was reading the printing on the wall, I squinted at the 2 posters and moved my lips.
This fellow was a driver. Says here he was in his car, and these 2 terrorist guys came up to him."
"Then?"
"Says he pretended he didn't know they were terrorists and took them for a ride around Delhi in his car. Then he stopped the car in a dark spot and smashed a bottle and cut their necks with it. I slashed 2 necks with my thumb."
"What kind of bottle?"
"An English liquor bottle. They tend to be pretty solid."
"I know," he said. "I used to go to the English liquor shop for my master every Friday. He liked Smirnoff."
"Smirnoff," I said, but he wasn't listening. He was peering again at the photo in the poster. Suddenly, he put his hand on my shoulder.
"You know who this fellow in the poster looks like?"
"Who?"
I asked.
He grinned.
"Me."
I looked at his face, and I looked at the photo.
"It's true," I said, slapping him on the back.
"I told you, it could be the face of half the men in India."
And then, because I felt sorry for that poor illiterate, thinking he had just endured what my father must have endured at so many railway stations, being mocked and hoodwinked by strangers, I bought him a cup of tea before going back to the train.
"Sir, I am not a politician or a parliamentarian, not one of those extraordinary men who can kill and move on as if nothing had happened. It took me 4 weeks in Bangalore to calm my nerves. For those 4 weeks, I did the same thing again and again. I left the hotel, a small seedy place near the train station that I had taken after leaving a deposit of 500 rupees every morning at 8, and walked around with a bag full of cash in my hands for 4 hours. I dared not leave it in the hotel room before returning for lunch. Dharam and I ate together. What he did to keep himself amused in the mornings, I don't know, but he was in good spirits. This was the first holiday he had had in his whole life. His smiles cheered me up. Lunch was 4 rupees a plate. The food is good value in the south. It is strange food, though. Vegetables cut up and served in watery curries. Then I went up to my room and slept. At 4 o'clock, I came down and ordered a pack of parlour milk biscuits and a tea, because I did not know yet how to drink the coffee. I was eager to try coffee. You see, poor people in the north of this country drink tea, and poor people in the south drink coffee. Who decided that things should be like this, I don't know, but it's like this. So this was the first time I was smelling coffee on a daily basis. I was dying to try it out, but before you could drink it, you had to know how to drink it. There was an etiquette, a routine associated with it that fascinated me. It was served in a cup set into a tumbler, and then it had to be poured in certain quantities and sipped at a certain speed from the tumbler. How the pouring was to be done, how the sipping was to be done, I did not know. For a while I only watched. It took me a week to realize that everyone was doing it differently. One man poured all the coffee into his tumbler at once, another never used the tumbler at all. "They're all strangers here," I said to myself. "They're all drinking coffee for the first time." That was another of the attractions of Bangalore. The city was full of outsiders. No one would notice one more. I spent 4 weeks in that hotel near the railway station, doing nothing. I admit, there were doubts in my mind. Should I have gone to Mumbai instead? But the police would have thought of that at once. Everyone goes to Mumbai in the films after they kill someone, don't they? Calcutta. I should have gone there. One morning, Dharam said, "Uncle, you look so depressed. Let's go for a walk." We walked through a park where drunken men lay on benches amid wild, overgrown weeds. We came out onto a broad road. On the other side of the road stood a huge stone building with a golden lion on top of it.
What is that building, Uncle?
I don't know, Dharam. It must be where the ministers live in Bangalore. On the gable of the building I saw a slogan, Government work is God's work.
You're smiling, Uncle.
You're right, Dharam. I am smiling. I think we'll have a good time in Bangalore, I said, and I winked at him. I moved out of the hotel and took a flat on rent. Now I had to make a living in Bangalore. I had to find out how I could fit into this city. I tried to hear Bangalore's voice just as I had heard Delhi's. I went down MG Road and sat down at the Cafe Coffee Day, the one with the outdoor tables. I had a pen and a piece of paper with me, and I wrote down everything I overheard. I completed that computer program in 2.5 minutes. An American today offered me $400,000 for my startup, and I told him, that's not enough. Is Hewlett-Packard a better company than IBM? Everything in the city, it seemed, came down to one thing. Outsourcing, which meant doing things in India for Americans over the phone. Everything flowed from it. Real estate, wealth, power, sex. So I would have to join this outsourcing thing one way or the other. The next day I took an auto rickshaw up to Electronic City. I found a banyan tree by the side of a road, and I sat down under it. I sat and watched the buildings until it was evening, and I saw all the SUVs racing in, and then I watched until 2 in the morning. And the SUVs began racing out of the buildings. And I thought, that's it. That's how I fit in.
Let me explain, Your Excellency.
See, men and women in Bangalore live like the animals in a forest do. Sleep in the day and then work all night, until 2, 3, 4, 5 o'clock, depending, because their masters are on the other side of the world in America. Big question. How would the boys and girls especially, get from home to the workplace in the late evening, and then get back home at 3 in the morning. There is no night bus system in Bangalore, no train system like in Mumbai. The girls would not be safe on buses or trains anyway. The men of this city, frankly speaking, are animals. That's where entrepreneurs come in. The next thing I did was to go to a Toyota Qualis dealer in the city and say, in my sweetest voice, I want to drive your cars. The dealer looked at me, puzzled. I couldn't believe I had said that. Once a servant, always a servant. The instinct is always there, inside you, somewhere near the base of your spine. If you ever came to my office, Mr. Premier, I would probably try to press your feet at once. I pinched my left palm. I smiled as I held it pinched and said, in a deep, gruff voice, I want to rent your cars. The last stage in my amazing success story, sir, was to go from being a social entrepreneur to a business entrepreneur. This part wasn't easy at all. I called them all up, one after the other, the officers of all the outsourcing companies in Bangalore. Did they need a taxi service to pick up their employees in the evening? Did they need a taxi service to drop off their employees late at night? And you know what they all said, of course. One woman was kind enough to explain. You're too late. Every business in Bangalore already has a taxi service to pick up and drop off their employees at night. I'm sorry to tell you this. It was just like starting out in Dhanbad. I got depressed. I lay in bed a whole day. What would Mr. Ashok do? I wondered. Then it hit me. I wasn't alone. I had someone on my side. I had thousands on my side. You'll see, my friends, when you visit Bangalore, fat, paunchy men swinging their canes on Brigade Road, poking and harassing vendors and shaking them down for money. I'm talking of the police, of course. The next day, I paid a local to be a translator. You know, I'm sure, that the people of the north and the south in my country speak different languages, and went to the nearest police station. In my hand, I had the red bag. I acted like an important man, and made sure the policeman saw the red bag by swinging it a lot, and gave them a business card I had just had printed. Then I insisted on seeing the big man there, the inspector. At last they let me into his office. The red bag had done the trick. The big man sat at a huge desk with shiny badges on his khaki uniform and the red marks of religion on his forehead. Behind him were three portraits of gods, but not the one I was looking for. Oh, thank God, there was one of Gandhi too. It was in the corner. With a big smile and a namaste, I handed him the red bag. He opened it cautiously. I said via the translator, "Sir, I want to make a small offering of my gratitude to you." It's amazing. The moment you show cash, everyone knows your language. "A gratitude for what?" the inspector asked in Hindi, peering into the bag with one eye closed. "For all the good you are doing to me, sir." He counted the money, 10,000 rupees, heard what I wanted, and asked for double. I gave him a bit more and was happy. "I tell you, Mr. Premier, my poster was right there, the one that I had seen earlier the whole time I was negotiating with him, the wanted poster, with the dirty little photo of me." 2 days later, I called up the nice woman at the internet company who had turned me down and heard a shocking tale. Her taxi service had been disrupted. A police raid had discovered that most of the drivers did not have licenses. "I'm so sorry, madam," I said. "I offer you my sympathies. In addition, I offer you my company, White Tiger Drivers." "Do all your drivers have licenses?" "Of course, madam. You can call the police and check." She did just that and called me back. I think the police must have put in a good word for me, and that was how I got my own, as they say in English, start-up. I was one of the drivers in the early days, but then I gave up. I don't really think I ever enjoyed driving, you know? Talking is much more fun. Now the startup has grown into a big business. We've got 16 drivers who work in shifts with 26 vehicles. Yes, it's true. A few 100,000 rupees of someone else's money and a lot of hard work can make magic happen in this country. Put together my real estate and my bank holdings, and I am worth 15 times the sum I borrowed from Mr. Ashok. See for yourself at my website. See my motto. We drive technology forward in English. See the photos of my fleet, 26 shining new Toyota Qualises, all fully air-conditioned for the summer months, all contracted out to famous technology companies. If you like my SUVs, if you want your call center boys and girls driven home in style, just click where it says, "Contact Ashok Sharma now." Yes, Ashok. That's what I call myself these days. Ashok Sharma, North Indian entrepreneur settled in Bangalore. If you were sitting here with me, under this big chandelier, I would show you all the secrets of my business. You could stare at the screen of my silver Macintosh laptop and see photos of my SUVs, my drivers, my garages, my mechanics, my paid-off policemen. All of them belong to me, Munna, whose destiny was to be a sweet maker. You'll see photos of my boys, too, all 16 of them. Once I was a driver to a master, but now I am a master of drivers. I don't treat them like servants. I don't slap or bully or mock anyone. I don't insult any of them by calling them my family, either. They're my employees. I'm their boss. That's all. I make them sign a contract, and I sign it too, and both of us must honor that contract. That's all. If they notice the way I talk, the way I dress, the way I keep things clean, they'll go up in life. If they don't, they'll be drivers all their lives. I leave the choice up to them. When the work is done, I kick them out of the office. No chit-chat, no cups of coffee. A white tiger keeps no friends. It's too dangerous. Now, despite my amazing success story, I don't want to lose contact with the places where I got my real education in life. The road and the pavement. I walk about Bangalore in the evenings or in the early mornings just to listen to the road. One evening, when I was near the train station, I saw a dozen or so manual laborers gathered together in front of a wall and talking in low tones. they were speaking in a strange language. They were the locals of the place. I didn't have to understand their words to know what they were saying. In a city where so many had streamed in from outside, they were the ones left behind. They were reading something on that wall. I wanted to see what it was, but they stopped their talking and crowded in front of the wall. I had to threaten to call the police before they parted and let me see what they had been reading. It was a stenciled image of a pair of hands smashing its manacles. "The great socialist is coming to Bangalore." In a couple of weeks, he arrived. He had a big rally here and gave a terrific speech, all about fire and blood and purging this country of the rich, because there was going to be no fresh water for the poor in 10 years, because the world was getting hotter. I stood at the back and listened. At the end, people clapped like crazy. There is a lot of anger in this town, that's for sure. Keep your ears open in Bangalore, in any city or town in India, and you will hear stirrings, rumors, threats of insurrection. Men sit under lampposts at night and read. Men huddle together and discuss and point fingers to the heavens. One night, will they all join together? Will they destroy the rooster coop? Ha! Maybe once in 100 years there is a revolution that frees the poor. I read this in one of those old textbook pages people in tea stalls used to wrap greasy samosas with. See, only 4 men in history have led successful revolutions to free the slaves and kill their masters, this page said. Alexander the Great, Abraham Lincoln of America, Mao of your country, and a 4th man. It may have been Hitler, I can't remember. But I don't think a 5th name is getting added to the list any time soon. An Indian revolution? No, sir, it won't happen. People in this country are still waiting for the war of their freedom to come from somewhere else, from the jungles, from the mountains, from China, from Pakistan. That will never happen. Every man must make his own Benaras. The book of your revolution sits in the pit of your belly, young Indian. Crap it out and read. Instead of which they're all sitting in front of color TVs and watching cricket and shampoo advertisements. On the topic of shampoo advertisements, Mr. Premier, I must say that golden-colored hair sickens me now. I don't think it's healthy for a woman to have that color of hair. I don't trust the TV or the big outdoor posters of white women that you see all over Bangalore. I go from my own experience now, from the time I spend in 5-star hotels. That's right, Mr. Jabal. I don't go to red-light districts anymore. It's not right to buy and sell women who live in bird cages and get treated like animals. I only buy girls I find in 5-star hotels. Based on my experience, Indian girls are the best. Well, 2nd best. I tell you, Mr. Jabal, it's one of the most thrilling sights you can have as a man in Bangalore to see the eyes of a pair of Nepali girls flashing out at you from the dark hood of an auto rickshaw. In fact, the sight of these golden-haired foreigners, and you'll discover that Bangalore is full of them these days, has only convinced me that the white people are on the way out. All of them look so emaciated, so puny. You'll never see one of them with a decent belly. For this I blame the President of America. He has made buggery perfectly legal in his country, and men are marrying other men instead of women. This was on the radio. This is leading to the decline of the white man. Then white people use cell phones too much, and that is destroying their brains. It's a known fact. Cell phones cause cancer in the brain and shrink your masculinity. The Japanese invented them to diminish the white man's brain and balls at the same time. I overheard this at the bus stand one night. Until then I had been very proud of my Nokia, showing it to all the call center girls I was hoping to dip my beak into, but I threw it away at once. Every call that you make to me, you have to make it on a landline. It hurts my business, but my brain is too important, sir. It's all that a thinking man has in this world. White men will be finished within my lifetime. There are blacks and reds, too, but I have no idea what they're up to. The radio never talks about them. My humble prediction In 20 years' time, it will be just us yellow men and brown men at the top of the pyramid, and we'll rule the whole world. And God save everyone else. Now, I should explain about that long interruption in my narrative 2 nights ago. It will also allow me to illustrate the differences between Bangalore and Laxmangar. Understand, Mr. Jabao, it is not as if you come to Bangalore and find that everyone is moral and upright here. This city has its share of thugs and politicians. It's just that here, if a man wants to be good, he can be good. In Laxmangar, he doesn't even have this choice. That is the difference between this India and that India. The choice. See, that night, I was sitting here telling you my life story when my landline began to ring. Still chatting to you, I picked up the receiver and heard Mohammed Asif's voice. Sir, there's been some trouble. That's when I stopped talking to you. What kind of trouble? I asked. I knew Mohammed Asif had been on duty that night, so I braced myself for the worst. There was a silence, and then he said, I was taking the girls home when we hit a boy on a bicycle. He's dead, sir. Call the police at once, I said. But, sir, I am at fault. I hit him, sir. That's exactly why you will call the police. The police were there when I got to the scene with an empty van. The Qualis was parked by the side of the road. The girls were all still inside. There was a body, a boy, lying on the ground, bloodied. The bike was on the ground, smashed and twisted. Mohammed Asif was standing off to the side, shaking his head. Someone was yelling at him, yelling with the passion that you only see on the face of the relative of a dead man. The policeman on the scene had stalled everyone. He nodded when he saw me. We knew each other very well by now. That's the dead boy's brother, sir, he whispered to me. He's in a total rage. I haven't been able to get him out of here. I shook Mohammed Asif out of his trance. Take my car and get these women home first of all. Let my boy go, I told the policeman loudly. He's got to get the people in their home. Whatever you want to deal with, you deal with me. How can you let him go? The brother of the dead boy yelled at the policeman. Look here, son, I said. I am the owner of this vehicle. Your fight is with me, not with this driver. He was following my orders to drive as fast as he could. The blood is on my hands, not his. These girls need to go home. Come with me to the police station. I offer myself as your ransom. Let them go. The policeman played along with me. It's a good idea, son. We need to register the case at the station. While I kept the brother engaged by pleading to his reason and human decency, Mohammed Asif and all the girls got into my van and slipped away. That was the first objective, to get the girls home. I have signed a contract with their company, and I honor all that I sign. I went to the police station with the dead boy's brother. The policeman on night duty brought me coffee. They did not bring the boy coffee. He glared at me as I took the cup. He looked ready to tear me to pieces. I sipped. The assistant commissioner will be here in 5 minutes, one of the policemen said. Is he the one who's going to register the case? The brother asked. Because no one has done it so far. I sipped some more. The assistant commissioner who sat in the station was a man whom I had lubricated often. He had fixed a rival for me once. He was the worst kind of man, who had nothing in his mind but taking money from everyone who came to his office. Scum. But he was my scum. My heart lifted at the sight of him. He had come all the way to the station at night to help me out. There is honesty among thieves, as they say. He understood the situation immediately. Ignoring me, he went up to the brother and said, What is it you want? I want to file an FIR, the brother said. I want this crime recorded. What crime? The death of my brother by this man's, pointing a finger at me, vehicle. The assistant commissioner looked at his watch. My God, it's late. It's almost 5 o'clock. Why don't you go home now? We'll forget you were here. We'll let you go home. What about this man? Will you lock him up first? The assistant commissioner put his fingers together. He sighed. See,
At the time of the accident, your brother's bicycle had no working lights. That is illegal, you know. There are other things that will come out. I promise you, things will come out.
The boy stared.
He shook his head, as if he hadn't heard correctly.
My brother is dead. This man is a killer. I don't understand what's going on here.
Look here. Go home. Have a bath. Pray to God. Sleep. Come back in the morning. We'll file the F.I.R. then. All right?
The brother understood at last why I had brought him to the station. He understood at last that the trap had shut on him. Maybe he had only seen policemen in Hindi movies until now.
Poor boy.
This is an outrage. I'll call the papers. I'll call the lawyers. I'll call the police.
The assistant commissioner, who was not a man given to humor, allowed himself a little smile.
Sure. Call the police.
The brother stormed out, shouting more threats.
The number plates will be changed tomorrow, the assistant commissioner said. We'll say it was a hit and run. Another car will be substituted. We keep battered cars for this purpose here.
You're very lucky that your Qualis hit a man on a bicycle.
I nodded.
A man on a bicycle getting killed. The police don't even have to register the case. A man on a motorbike getting killed. They would have to register that. A man in a car getting killed. That would have thrown me in jail.
What if he goes to the papers?
The assistant commissioner slapped his belly. I've got every pressman in this town in here. I did not hand him an envelope at once. There is a time and a place for these things. Now was the time to smile and say thanks and sip the hot coffee he had offered me. Now was the time to chat with him about his sons. They're both studying in America. He wants them to come back and start an internet company in Bangalore, and nod and smile and show him my clean, shining, fluoridated teeth. We sipped cup after cup of steaming coffee under a calendar that had the face of the goddess Lakshmi on it. She was showering gold coins from a pot into the river of prosperity. Above her was a framed portrait of the god of gods, a grinning Mahatma Gandhi. A week from now I'll go to see him again with an envelope, and then he won't be so nice. He'll count the money in front of me and say, this is all. Do you know how much it costs to keep two sons studying in a foreign college? You should see the American Express bills they send me every month. And he'll ask for another envelope, then another, and so on. There is no end to things in India, Mr. Jabal, as Mr. Ashok so correctly used to say. You'll have to keep paying and paying the fuckers. But I complain about the police the way the rich complain, not the way the poor complain. The difference is everything. The next day, sir, I called Muhammad Asif to the office. He was burning with shame over what he had done. I didn't need to reproach him. And it was not his fault. Not mine either. Our outsourcing companies are so cheap that they force their taxi operators to promise them an impossible number of runs every night. To meet such schedules, we have to drive recklessly. We have to keep hitting and hurting people on the roads. It's a problem every taxi operator in this city faces. Don't blame me.
Don't worry about it, Asif, I said. The boy looked so devastated.
I've come to respect Muslims, sir. They're not the brightest lot, except for those four poet fellows. But they make good drivers, and they're honest people, by and large, although a few of them seem to get this urge to blow trains up every year. I wasn't going to fire Asif over this. But I did ask him to find out the address of the boy, the one we had killed. He stared at me.
Why go, sir? We don't have to fear anything from the parents. Please don't do this.
I made him find the address, and I made him give it to me. I took cash out of my locker, in crisp new 100-rupee notes. I put them in a brown envelope. I got into a car and drove myself to the place. The mother was the one who opened the door. She asked me what I wanted, and I said, I am the owner of the taxi company. I didn't have to tell her which one. She brought me a cup of coffee in a cup, set in a metal tumbler. They have exquisite manners, these South Indians. I poured the coffee into the tumbler and sipped the correct way. There was a photo of a young man with a large jasmine garland around it.
up on the wall. I said nothing until I finished the coffee. Then I put the brown envelope on the table. An old man had come into the room now, and he stood staring at me. "First of all, I want to express my deep sorrow at the death of your son. Having lost relatives myself, so many of them, I know the pain that you have suffered. He should not have died. Second, the fault is mine, not the driver's. The police have let me off. That is the way of this jungle we live in. But I accept my responsibility. I ask you for forgiveness." I pointed to the brown envelope lying on the table. "There are 25,000 rupees in here. I don't give it to you because I have to, but because I want to. Do you understand?" The old woman would not take the money. But the old man, the father, was eyeing the envelope. "At least you were man enough to come," he said. "I want to help your other son," I said. "He is a brave boy. He stood up to the police the other night. He can come and be a driver with me if you want. I would take care of him if you want." The woman clenched her face and shook her head. Tears poured out of her eyes. It was understandable. She might have had the hopes for that boy that my mother had for me, but the father was amenable. Men are more reasonable in such matters. I thanked him for the coffee, bowed respectfully before the bereaved mother, and left. Muhammad Asif was waiting for me at the office when I got back. He shook his head and said, "Why? Why did you waste so much money?" That's when I thought, maybe I've made a mistake. Maybe Asif will tell the other drivers I was frightened of the old woman, and they will think they can cheat me. It makes me nervous. I don't like showing weakness in front of my employees. I know what that leads to. But I had to do something different. Don't you see? I can't live the way the wild boar and the buffalo and the raven lived, and probably still live, back in Laxmangar. I am in the light now. Now, what happens in your typical murder weekly story, or Hindi film for that matter? A poor man kills a rich man. Good. Then he takes the money. Good. But then he gets dreams in which the dead man pursues him with bloody fingers saying, "Murderer! Murderer!" Doesn't happen like that in real life. Trust me, it's one of the reasons I've stopped going to Hindi films. There was just that one night when Granny came chasing me on a water buffalo, but it never happened again. The real nightmare you get is the other kind. You toss about in the bed dreaming that you haven't done it, that you lost your nerve and let Mr. Ashok get away, that you're still in Delhi, still the servant of another man. And then you wake up. The sweating stops. The heartbeat slows. You did it. You killed him. About 3 months after I came to Bangalore, I went to a temple and performed last rites there for all of them. Kusum, Kishan, and all my aunts, cousins, nephews, and nieces. I even said a prayer for the water buffalo. Who knows who has lived and who has not. And then I said to Kishan, and to Kusum, and to all of them, "Now leave me in peace." And they have, sir, by and large. One day I read a story in a newspaper. Family of 17 murdered in North Indian village. My heart began to thump. 17. That can't be right. That's not mine. It was just one of those 2-inch horror stories that appear every morning in the papers. They didn't give a name to the village. They just said it was somewhere in the darkness, near Gaya. I read it again and again. 17. There aren't 17 at home. I breathed out. But what if someone's had children? I crumpled that paper and threw it away. I stopped reading the newspaper for a few months after that, just to be safe. Look, here's what would have happened to them. Either the stork had killed them, or had some of them killed, and the others beaten. Now, even if by some miracle he or the police didn't do that, the neighbors would have shunned them. See, a bad boy in one family cast the village's reputation into the dust. So the villagers would have forced them out, and they'd have to go to Delhi, or Calcutta, or Mumbai, to live under some concrete bridge begging for their food, and without hope for the future. That's not much better than being dead. "What's that you say, Mr. Jabal? Do I hear you call me a cold-blooded monster?" There is a story I think I heard at a train station, sir. Or maybe I read it on the torn page that had been used to wrap an ear of roasted corn I bought at the market. I can't remember. It was a story of the Buddha. One day, a cunning Brahmin, trying to trick the Buddha, asked him, "Master, do you consider yourself a man or a god?" The Buddha smiled and said, "Neither. I am just one who has woken up while the rest of you are still sleeping." I'll give you the same answer to your question, Mr. Jabal. You ask, "Are you a man or a demon?" "Neither," I say. "I have woken up, and the rest of you are still sleeping, and that is the only difference between us. I shouldn't think of them at all, my family." "Dharam certainly doesn't. He's figured out what's happened by now. I told him at first we were going on a holiday, and I think he bought it for a month or two. He doesn't say a word, but sometimes I see him watching me out of the corner of his eye. He knows. At night, we eat together, sitting across the table, watching each other and not saying much. After he's done eating, I give him a glass of milk. 2 nights ago, after he finished his milk, I asked him, 'Don't you ever think of your mother?' Not a word. 'Your father?' He smiled at me and then he said, 'Give me another glass of milk, won't you, uncle?' I got up. He added, 'And a bowl of ice cream, too.' 'Ice cream is for Sundays, Dharam,' I said. 'No, it's for today.' And he smiled at me. 'Oh, he's got it all figured out, I tell you. Little blackmailing thug. He's going to keep quiet as long as I keep feeding him. If I go to jail, he loses his ice cream and glasses of milk, doesn't he? That must be his thinking. The new generation, I tell you, is growing up with no morals at all. He goes to a good school here in Bangalore, an English school. Now he pronounces English like a rich man's son. He can say pizza the way Mr. Ashok said it. And doesn't he love eating pizza, that nasty stuff? I watch with pride as he does his long division on a clean white paper at the dinner table. All these things I never learned. One day I know Dharam, the boy who is drinking my milk and eating my ice cream in big bowls, will ask me, 'Couldn't you have spared my mother? Couldn't you have written to her telling her to escape in time?' And then I'll have to come up with an answer. Or kill him, I suppose. But that question is still a few years away. Till then we'll have dinner together every evening. Dharam, last of my family, and me. That leaves only one person to talk about. My ex. I thought there was no need to offer a prayer to the gods for him, because his family would be offering very expensive prayers all along the Ganga for his soul. What can a poor man's prayers mean to the 36 million and 4 gods in comparison with those of the rich? But I do think about him a lot, and believe it or not, I do miss him. He didn't deserve his fate. I should have cut the mongoose's neck. Now, Your Excellency, a great leap forward in Sino-Indian relations has been taken in the past 7 nights. Hindi, chini, bye-bye, as they say. I have told you all you need to know about entrepreneurship, how it is fostered, how it overcomes hardships, how it remains steadfast to its true goals, and how it is rewarded with the gold medal of success. Sir, although my story is done, and my secrets are now your secrets, if you allow me, I would leave you with one final word. That's an old trick I learned from the great socialist. Just when his audience is yawning, he says, "One final word." And then he goes on for 2 more hours. Ha! When I drive down Hosur Main Road, when I turn into Electronics City Phase 1 and see the companies go past, I can't tell you how exciting it is to me. General Electric, Dell, Siemens, they're all here in Bangalore, and so many more are on their way. There is construction everywhere, piles of mud everywhere, piles of stones, piles of bricks. The entire city is masked in smoke, smog, powder, cement dust. It is under a veil. When the veil is lifted, what will Bangalore look like? Maybe it will be a disaster. slums, sewage, shopping malls, traffic.